Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. There are three other guys that are associated with this particular technical med. KC2WGV, John, WS2N Paul, Hal, K6DPZ. That group of guys tries to organize this enthusiastic crowd that wants to know more about wireless techniques and radio. The people who are curious. The people who really make progress are the ones that are curious. That's an opinion. Whether or not the TechNet is going to be an interesting one or a boring one is a function of you, because the majority of the material that we discuss is what you ask as questions. Not very much of what we do is pre-prepared. Although we do a little bit of that from time to time, discussing things like decibels and Smith chart and waveguide. Let me drop. A person signs into the technical net by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We don't need a great big long list of names of people that say they're listening. This TechNet's been around for 31 years. Right now, we believe somebody is listening. Okay. We'll also probably be later on discussing what people saw at the picnic today. Also, there was a flea market. And other nice events are coming up real soon. June is the high holy month for ham radio, where we've got the June VHF contest, we've got Field Day, all kinds of good things, and a number of flea markets. So some good things to look forward to. Give me a call as a name right now if you do have a question or a comment. K2LI, they'll be listening.
Bay Shore, yes.
Mobile and listening.
N1YDY, name is Hank, and I have a question.
Okay, I heard Vito. I heard Rich. I heard somebody named Mobile that was being stepped on. The person who said Mobile, give me your call letters and name one more time.
This is KG2 Queen Yankee Whiskey.
You also have YDY in there, Dick. Hank.
Yeah, I got YDY. I got Queen Yankee Whiskey. Queen Yankee Whiskey, what is your name, sir?
Yeah, the name here is Joe. Joe, yep.
Okay. Ready? Vito, Joe, Hank. Who else did I miss? And Rich. Who else did I miss so far?
Kilo, Bravo 2, Mike, Alpha, Romeo, Gabe, yes.
Okay, we got you, Gabe. We got more than enough to get started. Vito, the microwave voice of Bay Shore. Go right ahead, Vito. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Professor. Always a pleasure speaking to you. A question this evening, if I may. I have a Hanon receiver, an HQ120, 1939 vintage. Completely restored. It's cosmetically mint, like 1 to 10, it's a 10. It's been completely restored. Every capacitor, resistor, tubes, works beautifully. However, within a week or two ago, I moved it from one shelf to another, and when I went to turn it back on, the rectifier tube started flashing, and the fuse opened. So I assumed the tube was defective. I had the same issue with another Collins receiver I had, and I replaced that tube, and it solved the problem. But now I replaced it with a brand new rectifier tube. And within 15 to 20 seconds, the radio is on, it tube flashes again, and the fuse opens, it blows. Any ideas I can look for, Professor? Go ahead.
Yes, I do, Vito. Considering the age of the equipment, and considering the power supply probably has electrolytic capacitors somewhere, as time goes on, they can become open circuits, short circuits, and whatever. If the rectifier is trying to feed a filter capacitor bank that is the filtering for the power supply, and if that happens to be a short circuit to ground, you're now asking the rectifier tube to try to supply an infinite amount of current. It can't do that. It'll give you the visual effects you've seen. So the first thing I would do in your case is to, if you've got the schematic diagram, would really be helpful, is to look where the cathode of the rectifier tube goes to, and that's where the positive voltage is supposed to come. came out, put an ohm meter from there to ground, with a positive lead away from ground, and see if that does anything, that gives you any indication. It should be a rather high number of ohms. And you should also see a capacitor discharge effect on your ohm meter. In other words, your ohm meter will kick over, and as the capacitor is charged, you'll see it slowly move back to an infinite number of ohms. Another thing you can do is to connect a voltmeter lead to that cathode of the rectifier tube when you turn it on. Let's assume now that your power supply is supposed to produce, I'm picking a number out of the air now, 220 volts, and you see 50 volts, or you see 30 volts instead of 220. You know darn well something is loading the thing down, something fierce. So I think you've got a shorted power supply. The guy who has repaired that exact rig multiple times is Hal, K6DPZ. Let's see what Hal's got to say on this one. K6DPZ, K2LIW, in the tech man.
EGV would comment also, Dick.
Hal first, and then John. Go ahead, Hal. Okay, maybe Hal's not available right now. He's trading from one antenna to another to find out which antenna works better. John, I wonder if you've run into a HQ-120. Here we go, HQ-120. You got it, John.
I have the wrong microphone. Should I take it first?
Well, Dick, not on that exact model, but my recommendation is first, unload the B-plus circuit, disconnect it. Put about a 20K ohm resistor on the output, bring it up on a variac, and start checking the power supply that way. Check the filters with a scope and proceed that way. Do not leave the B-plus line loaded. That's a good way to check it out. So that's one of my recommendations. KC2WGV, back to you, Dick.
6DPZ here, I just grabbed the wrong mic.
Yeah, in other words, you're saying John slowly sneak up on this one approach. Okay, now Hal has the right mic. Go right ahead, Hal.
The first thing, if it's blowing fuses and the rectifier tube is flashing, first thing to do is pull the rectifier tube out totally, put a fuse back in, and see if you're still blowing fuses. That would tell me if your transformer may have an arc to ground on a high voltage winding. If it doesn't blow fuses when you pull the rectifier tube out totally, then you know it's beyond the rectifier tube that your problem is happening. That's the first step.
Julio, Dick. Yeah, these sounds like good approaches we got here. As you can tell, Vito, we're doing a divide and conquer. The example I often use is an automobile engine that won't run, or a lawnmower engine that won't run. Does it have gas? Does it have spark? And then after that, does it have carburation? So we're finding out now, is the power supply transformer got a funny short circuit? Let's see. I'm guessing that Rich has also repaired some HQ-120s. Let's see what he's run into. N2EO, K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. The requirement was you clear one start.
I like the idea of what Hank just said, Hal. With the rectifier tube unplugged, does it blow a fuse? Does it draw a high current? You could, if you want to, put a 110-volt light bulb in series with it, and therefore, even if it draws high current, the light bulb will simply light and nothing bad can happen. But step by step, do you have a transformer, and do you have a shorted power supply? And those things will make your rectifier tube a flash like that, Hal. So, you quite possibly will get a chance to do some of those tests before the technet's over, in which case you come back and tell us what you found. Also, what was I going to say? Be a little bit careful, because you're playing with some relatively high voltages. With all of your telephone experience, I know you know how to handle high voltage. I'm just telling you to make double dot sure, that when you're doing these measurements, one hand is in your pocket. WA2PJF, K2LIW, go ahead. I'm terrible on names tonight. Vito.
Okay, what Hal said, take the rectifier tube, the 5V4, which is a brand new one I just purchased, and remove that from the socket and see if the fuse goes open. If it doesn't, now, where am I at that stage? I still don't understand. Go ahead.
If the center tap of the transformer was, let me think about that now. The usual way is the center tap is ground, the two halves of the transformer go to the two plates of the 5V4. So that's confirming that there isn't a shorted lead in the transformer. If it doesn't blow a fuse without the tube, then my next guess is that the cathode of the tube, by way of the schematic diagram, you'll know where the cathode is. I would measure ohms between cathode and ground of the tube before you turn it on. Is there a short circuit in the power supply? If you get some reasonable number of high ohms there isn't an obvious short in the power supply, next thing I would do is put a voltmeter on the cathode lead of the vacuum tube, plug the vacuum tube back in, and with your voltmeter set at the 300-volt scale, turn it back on very briefly, maybe with a 110-volt light bulb in series to give you current limiting, and see if you get a reasonable number of volts. Assuming your power supply is supposed to be, I'm picking numbers now, 220 volts, and instead of getting 220 volts, your voltmeter measures 20 volts, and stop right there. Something is loading down the power supply, overloading the rectifier tube, and that's why it's flashing, and then you've got to find that short circuit. My first guess is old-fashioned tantalum or electrolytic capacitors. After that number of years, they are known to fail. So you're going to have to then, with your ohmmeter, find the shorted electrolytic capacitor. I'm reasonably sure that you've got a defective power supply filter network. That's what I think you're looking for here, Vito. WA2PJF, K2LIW.
DTZ with another comment. A very common problem in that radio is the audio output transformer develops an internal short. That makes it draw excessive current. All sorts of happiness happens to the power supply.
Okay, very well. The capacitors have all been replaced with the last couple of months. So they're all brand new. But okay, Hal made a point there also as well. All right, I'll kick it around. I'll look at the schematic. I'll see what I come up with. I don't want to tie things up any longer than I have, but you give me a direction. Thank you, gentlemen. WA2PJF is clear. Thank you so much.
With that audio output transformer giving you a short to ground, you will be able to detect that, Vito, with your ohmmeter. When you put your ohmmeter across what you think is a capacitor, which of course is part of the power supply, and it's feeding that high voltage to the audio output transformer, you'll measure a mysterious number of ohms to ground. With just an ohmmeter on everything turned off, you should measure, I'm going to pick a number, 100,000 ohms. And if you suddenly measure 1,000 ohms, that's very suspicious. So your ohmmeter, even before you turn it on, will help you find that shorted audio output transformer that Hal thinks is a fairly frequent failure on that particular radio. So power supply failures are really what you're looking for. Somebody is eating your lunch and drawing extra current to ground, and with your ohmmeter, you're eventually going to find that. Wes, what was your question on this one? N2XJN, K2LIW.
I have one last thing I want to say, and Wes could take it, okay?
Go ahead.
The problem I found in that model radio the coupling capacitor between the first audio and the audio output tube short out. The audio output tube will draw an enormous amount of current and cause the power supply and also the rectifier tube to heat up and spark. Pull out your audio output tube. That's the first high current tube being pulled off the power supply and see if you still have any high short or high current. That's my comment.
Another goodie. I'm going to give you a couple of extra words on that one, Vito. The tube that feeds your audio output vacuum tube has a coupling capacitor from the plate of the previous tube into the grid of that tube. If that coupling capacitor becomes leaky, you're starting to take some of the high voltage from the previous tube, couple it onto the control grid of your audio output tube, pulling that control grid positive, and that's one of the most potent tubes you've got in that rig other than the rectifier. And so if somebody puts extra positive voltage on his control grid, that tube will draw a whole lot of current and could give you the condition you're seeing. N2XJN, go ahead, Wes. K2LAW.
I have a question about coaxial cable that is shortest and the standing waves. So if you can handle it, I would be happy to hear you out.
Okay, you're changing subjects, Wes. The way you would detect what we're discussing right now, Vito, is that if you do turn it on briefly and you don't blow the power supply, if you don't blow the fuse right away, a voltmeter that you've connected to the control grid of the audio output tube, you can turn it on briefly and before bad things happen and see what voltage you're getting on that control grid. And if you're starting to see a positive voltage, that would give you a strong indication of a leaky coupling capacitor, coupling audio into the control grid of that tube. And then an ohmmeter across that capacitor will give you a clue. So step by step, by starting off with first the vacuum tube for the rectifier out, doesn't blow a fuse, that implies you've got a pretty good transformer. Then with the audio output tube unplugged, but the rectifier plugged in, all things normal, that would suggest that the audio, something has to do with the audio output the tube and so on. I guess you could, in fact, do an experiment where plugging in each one of the tubes one at a time and then seeing what happens. That would also give you some pretty good clues, but there's lots of ways of dividing and conquering, and as you carry out these procedures, Vito, later on during the net, I think there's a 50-50 chance you're going to come back and say, hey, look what I found. Okay, Vito, the next person who signed in was Joe, Kilo Delta 2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet. Please wait for all four beeps. I didn't.
K2QIQ,
thanks
for the comments on the last
topic. Hang on, Joe. Go ahead, Glenn. K2QIQ, you got it.
Yeah, good evening, Vic, and some very, very good comments on that. It's just the two I didn't hear that I think I would also try, that's always worth a thing, is one of the things he suggested was he moved the cabinet from one shelf to another. It's still a very good visual. Look around and see if anything mechanically is loose or intermittent, that, you know, maybe something, when during movement, if something was loose, it could be touching something and creating a short. The other thing I would think of also is sometimes removing all the other tubes, and just if he has a tube checker, just to verify that all the other tubes don't have shorts or anything crazy on them. Back to you, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, it's a bit of a long shot, but occasionally a tube will develop an internal short. And the process of moving it, particles that were freely floating around inside that tube decided to arc themselves between the anode and ground, so to speak, and create a short circuit. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Another thing Beetle might want to do, he can lower the rating of the fuse so he doesn't damage the transformer while he's doing those examinations. If he eliminates the heater load, which is probably has nothing to do with this issue, he'll be able to troubleshoot it with a lot more safety on a power transformer by lowering the fuse load. That's it. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
No, that doesn't always work.
Yeah, that one I don't recommend. I'm not quite as enthusiastic about that one. If the fuse was properly sized, then the fuse is giving a moderate amount of protection to the audio output transformer, the main power supply transformer, and so on. Let's see what Eric's going to say on this one. KE2EJ, KE2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
KE2LAW, KE2EJ. I've fixed a lot of stuff in my day, and I'm a fan of the light bulb, sorry. I like that self-limiting brightness. You can put a small fuse in when you have something that it gives you a real dead short and a discharge. Sometimes you damage components. Reducing the size of the fuse seems logical, but when it comes to transients, it's not very helpful. I've seen people take that logic a step and blow things up in the process and wonder why that happened. You know, the best tool that Vito has really is an ohm meter. See what's coming out, see what the resistance is at the kappa, and work your way down. It's just one of those things. And by the way, if the audio output transformer is short, it's yanking the tube, it's juice still going to blow. So, there you go. K2RWP,
good comment, Dick.
Yeah, what we are saying here with your ohm meter, Vito, if you do put your ohm meter on the cathode of the rectifier tube, with the rig, of course, unplugged and everything discharged, and you measure anything less than, let me pick a number, 100,000 ohms, then you start, let's assume that you measure 10,000 ohms, and then there's either a power supply filter choke, an other component downrange of the power supply. You start moving your ohm meter downrange and keep looking for lower and lower number of ohms. As you finally get to the component that the power supply was connected to, that's doing all the extra current drain, you're going to measure the minimum number of ohms. So move that ohm meter on all the B-plus leads and all of everything it connects to, including that audio output transformer, and as you start moving closer to the thing that's creating a short, you're going to measure a smaller number of ohms. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Got one more comment.
John first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, John.
To get the beep. Okay, the recommendation of lowering the fuse, if he pulls out all of the tubes, that's a current supply that's going through that fuse. Now the short has the ability to draw more wattage through that load, and that can cause problems. That's the only reason I recommended that.
I like Eric's idea of the light bulb in series with the rig. A 100-watt light bulb can give you all kinds of protection. If the rig is working correctly, the light bulb will not light. If the light bulb lights...
The light bulb will light. It'll probably light dim, but it'll light, and it'll look brighter with modulation.
Understand. But the light bulb is a beautiful limiting device where you're not burning up a whole box full of fuses, and it's giving you a very strong indication. And if something went wrong with the radio, and it becomes a dead short, nothing bad happens. The light bulb simply lights. KE2EJ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Eric.
ZPZ with another comment.
Eric and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the light bulb is my favorite thing. Especially when I'm working on solid state stuff. The ball stage is a couple of microseconds to kill a junction. That's the favorite way to fix the audio amplifiers, by the way. It's a good output transition. Light bulb lights up, you don't let the smoke out of the place. One thing I will say is that it's kind of a feel when you're troubleshooting. And interestingly enough, we're talking about finding a short here. I don't know how many people work on solid state stuff, but in the days of leaded parts, and even in circuit mount stuff, most digital chips have bypass capacitors between the power supply rail and ground. And you may have several hundreds of them. Let me know to drop your thing.
And by the way, you can use a little more audio, Eric. I'm sorry, I can fix that. You may have several hundred bypass capacitors across these various different chips, although it's happening less these days with the higher density chips. But how do you find a bad one? How do you find one that's shortest? Well, maybe with the, you've got a bad one somewhere amongst these hundred capacitors. I've got this cute little probe that's actually a current probe. It's an inductive current probe.
It's like a little ampro. You run it along the trace, you find the cap that's drawing the most current. Well, you could also do the same thing with high voltages with a little pickup coil. I just use an old tape recorder head. And you run down all of these brush lines until you find one with making the biggest feel. And there you have the bad part. So there's lots of different ideas of how to go about this. But, you know, the ohm meter is the very basic way to do it. And you can get really fancy if you want. But, you know, when it comes to finding it short, you just got to find out where it is. Get your IW, K2J, and then that gets over to hell.
Yeah, as a new guy to electronics, learns to use his volt ohm milliammeter, if it's an old-fashioned triplet or Simpson, beautiful testing piece of equipment, for a situation like this. A modern-day digital voltmeter works well, but there's a couple of cases where it can give you a little bit more trouble. I know that Vito and I go back a long way, so I think there's a good chance he owns a triplet or a Simpson volt ohm milliammeter. In this particular case, it's going to do a yeoman job of helping him find what's going on. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
K2RIW.
Right from the beach.
Okay, one other thing to do, if I remember that power supply correctly, it comes out of the rectifier, there's a choke, not radio. Each side of that choke, you have all your connections to the outside world, as far as D-plus to all the different stages. First start, lift up the first lead coming out of the rectifier going to the one side of the choke. See if you still have a short. If you still have a short, put that lead back. After the choke, you're going to have multiple leads coming to that other filter cap. I think that's a can cap, if I remember correctly, also. Lift all those leads, one at a time, or take them all off. If the short clears, then put one at a time back and see which one pulls the short. If all the leads are off and just the filter choke and the electrolytic are left and you still have a short, then your can is shorted, your electrolytic. Go ahead, K6DPZ.
And my understanding of this is that what Vito should be doing is all these ohm meter tests first before he starts opening up wires. The opening up wires are if the ohm meter test is not met. Yeah. The ohm meter test, when you first go to the cathode of the rectifier tube, that's a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, you should measure something like 100,000 ohms from there to ground. And if you measure a hell of a lot lower than that, start moving in the direction of lower number of ohms. But, there is the possibility that whatever is creating the short circuit only acts like a high current drain under high voltage conditions when the real voltage is there. And the 3 volts coming out of your volt ohm milliammeter, your VOM, is not enough to excite it, and therefore you don't see it. Then you start doing the unwiring of leads that Hal just gave you suggestions for. So lots and lots of ways of testing here, but any of the tests that you do with the thing plugged in and turned on, hopefully with a series light bulb, 100-watt light bulb, I do recommend you do all that testing with one hand in your pocket. You know that, Vito. Any final fills that you might need, Vito, the BA2PJF of Bayshore, K2RIW of Huntington.
Do we go with a comment, Dick? And do we go?
You've got it, Vito.
Okay, Dick. Okay, very good. I heard the whole thing, and I have the schematic in front of me here as we're speaking, and I will search this out, and I'm sure I can solve the mystery. All right, you've been all very helpful. Everyone has been. And I thank you so much. WA2PJF is clear. Bye-bye. Thank you, gentlemen.
And as you start making discoveries, Vito, we'll be looking forward to hearing you come back on later on, if you so decide to do so. And good luck with that operation. And you're allowed to come back multiple weeks with this one, if you want to. Okay, Joe is the next guy, KD2QYW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, Roger, it's funny, I just got back in my car from the gas station. My question is, today I have no questions. I'm just listening, and back to the net. Thank you, Dick.
Very fine, Joe. The the way you signed in led me to believe you did have a question or a comment. You had your golden opportunity. You could have told us what you really thought if you wanted to. Okay. Next guy on our list is Hank, I think it is. N1, Yankee Delta Yankee. If I got my, if I can read my own writing, you've got it, Hank. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Thanks, Dick. And I have a question about something I can't quite figure out. I have been looking at an antenna design, something called an Asante Sigma 4. And it was designed back in the 60s for CB, and I was thinking about using one for 10 meters, modifying it, obviously. But what I can't figure out about this thing is that it is a 0.82 wavelength radiator. Now, I understand how a 3/4 wavelength, such as a J-pole, might work, or at least I believe I do based on what's on the internet. But when I see something that describes itself as being a 0.82 radiator rather than a 0.75 radiator, I can't quite figure out how it might be working. The more I look at this in the, you know, in the web, the more mystery I see and the less factual stuff I see. So I was wondering if anybody on the TechNet had a good, simple explanation of how a skeletal sleeve monopole might actually work.
Yeah, when it comes to pure vertical antennas, many people believe that a 5/8 wave gives you the maximum signal on the horizon. And when you go with smaller or larger than that, then the signal on the horizon decreases. 5/8 wave is 0.625. And so your particular manufacturer is claiming 0.82, which maybe is part of a two-element collinear-like antenna. The so-called station master is a number of wavelengths tall in some cases, but it's broken up into individual segments where the individual segments are being separately fed, so to speak, so that each one is a half-wave radiator, electronically speaking, all in phase with each other. Let me drop. Now, I could make the so-called radiator of an antenna any length you want and still make the antenna work pretty well, but there's a catch. What you call the radiator, what you think is doing all the radiating, it combined with the circuitry connected to it, the combination must hit electronic resonance. You don't get anything you and I are willing to write home about as far as an antenna is concerned unless it resonates. The hidden piece of information that we amateurs have discovered a long time ago, and it's not written in any of the good antenna books. You want to build an antenna, you resonate first, then you can radiate. And if you make the antenna non-resonant, with the exception of an antenna that's a zillion wavelengths long, beverage or rhombic, those are so-called traveling wave antennas, except for those exceptions, whatever you use as an antenna will be resonating. So if you could hold your favorite grid tip meter that Hal often talks us about, you can hold your grid tip meter near that antenna when it's connected to normally to the transmitter and whatever, and if it hits resonance somewhere near the frequency you want to look at it, that you want to use it at, you stand a chance of getting some good radiation out of it. If it doesn't pass that test, then it's not going to work well. So manufacturers claim all kinds of crazy things when it comes to gain and length of the radiator, and they think it's got all kinds of mysterious properties. It's got to resonate first. N1YDY, K2LIW, go ahead, Hank.
Very good, Dick. I guess what I should have said is I looked at these things mechanically, and have you ever seen one? I guess that's the first question I should ask. Do you physically know what I'm talking about?
Avanti Sigma 4, 10-meter antenna. No, I haven't. Let me pass it over to the group and see if anyone is familiar with that antenna. Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the Tech Net. Okay, you're going to have to describe it to us, Hank. N1YDY, K2LIW.
Right. Think of it as a funny-looking vertical CB antenna where the radials, unlike a ground plane, which might be at 45 degrees downward or 90 degrees horizontal, these radials go up and they form a three or four-legged basket around the vertical radial, vertical radiator itself. And at the top of the radial, there is a ring, circular ring that goes around them. And then the center radial radiator extends up above them. And in some ways, and it's fed at the very bottom, not fed in the middle, and, but it's fed at the bottom with a gamma match. In some ways, it almost looks as if it's a J-pole that has, you know, electrically, that has three legs instead of one, or four legs instead of one at the bottom. But, you know, as I'm sure you know, a J-pole is billed as a end-fed half-wave radiator. So there's a quarter-wave matching section and a half-wave radiator, supposedly, which would give you three-quarter-wave to a vertical distance. So this thing, it's got this crazy number, 0.82, and it really doesn't say, it claims it's not a J-pole, it really doesn't say how it physically matches and works. So it's really a funny-looking vertical.
I'm slowly getting a picture of this one, Hank, and that is, there is a whole subset of antennas called sleeve dipole and sleeve monopole. That means that you've got the center radiator, and you've got another cylindrical object around the radiator that covers up a portion of its distance. Sleeve dipole and sleeve radiator, their greatest claim to fame is that they have considerably increased bandwidth of, let's say, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So this, where your radials are, four of them going up at some kind of an angle, and they've got a ring around them, it's beginning to look like a poor man's equivalent of a sleeve monopole. And once again, no matter how you physically configure the antenna, and by the way, that sleeve that you're describing with the ring around it, it is electronically covering up a portion of the bottom of that radiator. And even though that radiator is physically 0.82 wavelength long, because a portion of it is inside of the sleeve, not all of it is exposed to do its radiating directly. And maybe there's only 5/8 wave of it that's really doing the radiating, so to speak. There's a zillion different mechanical configurations for an antenna, but it's got to resonate. Now, you did call it a 10-meter antenna. You did relate it to other bands, like the Citizens band. Do you want to move the frequency of this, or just you want to understand how it is working? It is a different mechanical layout for a vertical antenna, as I see it, and as long as it hits resonance and as long as it gives you reasonable standing wave ratio without launching a whole lot of current on the outside of the coax cable, then in theory, it's got to work. If you've got any doubt about any of these antennas, let me drop them.
Hey, Dick, I'm looking at a picture of it.
Okay, give us your words on it, Eric. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, they have an SWR part that's pretty interesting. It's not that broad, but think of it this way. Think of a dish cone, invert it, put it at the bottom, okay, so it says spiders out there. At the top of the dish cone, which is about a third of the way up the center mass of the antenna, is a ring. And then it goes up from there. The way this thing is organized, it looks like it had a lot of gain. It doesn't have much gain. This thing is 2 dBi and 4.15 dBi. Bandwidth is not bad. It's 1400 kHz, which is pretty much the whole CB band. And of course, it'll take 1,000 watts and 2,000 watts per short time. The speed is a gamma match. And it's got a UHF connector on it, blah, blah, blah. All right. That should give you a little bit of a visual picture of what it looks like. It's really WKC.
Let me just jump in for a second.
Go ahead.
I had thought perhaps it was a 5/8 over the matching stuff, but even if the bottom's a quarter wave on whatever band you're using it, for it to have been 8.2 total length, then the top is only 5.7, which is 4.57, which is, you know, bigger than a J-pole and smaller than a 5/8 wave, bigger than a half-wave radiator and smaller than a 5/8 wave radiator. So, you know, it's just a little difficult for me to figure out electrically what's going on there. And yes, I wasn't really thinking of using it as a CB antenna. I was thinking of using it for 10 meter. But you know, before I got around to doing anything with it, I wanted to kind of understand how it worked.
They take the bottom segment of it, looks like that's how they get the cue so that they can get the bandwidth.
So the combination of the gamma match that Eric just described to us, the apparent sleeve-like function, one of the things that's going to make you a little bit disappointed is that many, many antennas, particularly CB antennas, television aerial antennas, and commercial antennas, the dirty little secret is that the majority of cases, the gain of the antenna, the claim for gain, is set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory, because the manufacturer realizes that a hell of a lot of people are trying to get the biggest bang for the dollar. So if one antenna claims 2.1 dB of gain, another one claims 2.4 dB of gain, the guy who claims the 2.4 raises his price a little bit because he thinks he's going to get more profit, because he thinks people are really going to be getting a whole lot of better performance. The bottom line of all this is that, let me drop. That is, unless you invest in a significant increase in real estate, in the case of a station master antenna, which in some cases is 10 and 18 feet high on 2 meters, where you've got a number of wavelengths of radiator sections, individual sections, where you've really invested in more real estate, now you stand a chance of generating higher gain by way of that so-called pancake pattern. But all of these antennas that are in the vicinity of quarter wave and half wave long, 5/8 wave and so on, 0.82 wavelength, you haven't made much of an investment in real estate. Therefore, you don't have the raw physics by which you can make a significant difference in directivity. That's what gain really comes from. As such, if you go through the MATLAB programs, among other programs, which will give you a three-dimensional plot of the antenna pattern, I call them the apple plots, you'll notice that almost all of those antennas look like a nice round red apple with a couple of knolls and a couple of directions where the stem comes out, if you know what I mean. So you're not going to get any huge difference in gain. And so if you're using an antenna with 2 dB of gain and you compare it to an antenna with 1.3 dB of gain, you think you're going to see a difference where it takes 6 dB of difference in gain to move the signal one S unit on the receiver? We're talking about very small differences here. So the bottom line is, don't worry about gain. Don't worry about exact length. Make sure that when you move it from 11 meters to 10 meters, if that's what you're about to do, shorten things, change things in such a way that it re-resonates. Once it resonates on the frequency you intended to use it on, you're almost home free. After that, if you have any suspicion, let me drop. If you have any suspicion that you've created some component in there and with the changes that is going to lower the efficiency, the only way you can lower the efficiency of an antenna is to burn up some of your power as heat. Put 100 watts or 10 watts into the antenna, do it for 10 minutes, and then turn off the power, go over there and touch everything. If everything's ice cold, by definition, it's running 99% efficiency. It's radiating all of that signal somewhere into space, and unless you've made a big investment in real estate, then you don't have much of an antenna pattern very different than the so-called donut pattern of a dipole, if you know what I mean. So make it resonate, and you're going to be almost all the way home free, Hank. And everything else is just some of it's advertising hyperbole, some of it's just different engineers having different ways of generating a similar-like antenna, monopole / dipole-like antenna. N1YDY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I have a quickie announcement, and I'll let you guys go. I just want to say something for the net.
Go ahead, Barry.
Hey, all you VHF freaks out there, I just want to let you know 2 meters is open this is KD8UD, which is about 230 miles from here, and I think it's getting better. It's just an announcement, and 2MB.
Okay, we're on 2 meters, and the 2 meter band is opening. For the guys who have got an all mode rig, single sideband, for instance, and you go down to 144-200, if Barry is even half right, you're going to hear a lot of activity. So back to you, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, guys, I'm going to say thanks very much. I don't want to take up any more time. You know, like I said, I really just wanted to figure out how this particular design might have worked. You know, I have a mental visual of how a dipole might work and how a mental visual of how a ground plane might work, but I had absolutely no clue how this thing was working. So thanks again, and I'll be happy to take your final comment and listen to what else is going on.
My first guess on the mental images people have given me is that
on that HQ120 and a comment for the net. Do you copy, sir? And to a yell.
I copy now, and I hope I will be able to continue to copy. Go ahead, Rich.
Hold up.
1 20 1 4 Jesse Form is dead. CZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Whoever jamming, this gentleman is very knowledgeable. He wasn't asked to use the repeater, but I think we should give him the courtesy of using the TechNet. He is very knowledgeable in the field, and we're missing a lot of important information. That's my comment here. K6DBZ.
Also, this is my comment, and to Xia.
I'm going to go on to the next person. Gabe, KB2MAR. K2RIW, go
right ahead, Gabe. K2RIW, KB2MAR. Well, on the subject of collinears, I have a question regarding 2-meter collinears. The question that I have is, when you make a collinear for 2 meters, for example, do you use half-wave elements or 5/8, or does it really matter? Is it harder to make it with 5/8 stacks rather than half-wave? Back to net. It's KB2MAR.
As I see it, Hank, there's sort of a yes and a no to that. The conventional way of making the station master-like antenna is to take lengths of individual lengths of hardline, stack them together. The individual lengths of hardline are electronically on half wavelength long when including the velocity factor of the center conductor of the semi-rigid pieces of cable. Then at each one of the half wavelength electrical lengths, which are a little bit shorter physically than half wave, you crisscross the center conductor and shield. And in theory, you can stack that a ridiculous number of elements like that, you could stack that way. And now what's really being radiated is that each one of the quasi-half wavelength length of semi-rigid cable are the individual radiators, and each one of them is now being fed in phase at the center frequency. Let me drop.
By the way, Rich, you are speaking with for Hank or me? I'm Gabe.
I assume it's Gabe who's asking about a collinear antenna. Am I talking to the right Gabe?
No, but you said Hank when you were starting to give an explanation. And I wasn't really asking, well, maybe you had to tell me about using a hard line for the elements for half wave and 5/8, but I was just curious what's the better way to do it for 2 meters. Would it be the 5/8 way to do it, to stack it, or half wave? I mean, that, maybe you're getting to my question exactly, you know what I'm saying?
The short answer is no.
The conventional way of doing it in the so-called station master technique, the individual chunks have to be half wave because of the way you're stacking them. That's the only way that these end-feeding crisscross techniques will electronically feed each of the elements as half-wave elements. Now, you could, if you want to, make a whole bunch of 5/8 wave elements, make a whole bunch of half-wave elements, make a whole bunch of full-wave elements if you want to. mechanically mount them onto a mast and then have individual feed lines going to them with a power divider. And now your individual elements of your collinear, because of your phasing harness feeding them, you can make each one of them whatever stacking distance you like and whatever number of wavelengths you like. But that would require individual feeding coax cables with a power divider system. The beauty, the mechanical beauty of the so-called station master is that you've got one feed point at the bottom feeding this whole vertical stack. As long as they're all electronically half-wave, it works. The nasty thing about the station master antenna is that as you make it higher by using a larger number of elements, the pancake pattern gets more and more narrow. Let me drop. And it becomes extremely frequency sensitive. By frequency sensitive, I mean two things. You deviate from the center frequency and the visuar goes to hell and gone real fast. Number two, even if you could impedance match it and feed it off frequency, because of the physical delay of each of the elements and you're feeding the bottom one and they're all being fed as a long series string, you go to a higher frequency. Each one of your elements is now going to be a longer wavelength than half wave. Therefore, you're getting a phase delay at the top. You go to a higher frequency, and your beautiful pancake pattern is now a very shallow cone above the horizon. Go to a lower frequency, and that pancake pattern is now an inverted cone below the horizon. So the station master technique is capable of giving you a lot of gain if you carry it to the ridiculous extreme. You better make sure the antenna is really vertical. You never want to mount one of those on the top of a sailboat that's going to be heeling over. And you've got to make sure that it's designed for a particular center frequency. To give you a little bit more of a feeling of what's going on here, Dave, KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QSL, if you the maximum of half waves that you can stack without the pancake pattern, you know, going in a different type of pattern, which is not that desirable, how much gain would that be off the top of your head, if you know? KB2MAR, back to you, Rich.
If you really want to push it to the absolute limit, Gabe, I don't think anybody has gone beyond about four elements, but there's nothing stopping you. You could go to 8 or 16 elements of vertical stacking. You better do an extremely careful design when you do that. Make sure that you know the exact amount of phase shift of each individual section that you're crisscrossing. As you go to higher and higher heights, and they're all being fed correctly, and that in itself is not an easy thing. You can say it very easily. To really do it is not easy. Your pancake pattern becomes more and more skinny on the horizon. The gain goes up. Nothing stopping you from getting almost 20 decibels of gain in that manner, omnidirectional on the horizon. 20 dB over isotropic is achievable. But boy, you're going to pay a price. It's going to be an extremely narrow antenna. The pancake pattern on the horizon is only going to be a few degrees high. The slightest amount of tilt of your tower, if the tower tilts a little bit to the east, that means to the east, the pancake pattern is below the horizon. To the west, it's above the horizon. You can see what happens here. You pick up some huge vulnerabilities by doing it that way. But the theory doesn't stop you from going a very large number of vertical stacking elements. The best vertical collinear antenna I know of, if you Google K1WHS, let me drop. Dave Olin, K1WHS, who is the president of a company called Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine. He's got a roughly 200-foot-high Rhone 55 tower on top of his mountain in his backyard. And on the side of that tower, he has 2-meter horizontally polarized, I think they're about 4-element or 5-element Yagis, but he's got these Yagis stacked 8 high. 8 individual Yagis vertically stacked, aimed down the east coast of the United States. And so if you could see that antenna pattern, it would be an extremely flat, very narrow beaver tail pattern, so to speak, aimed at the horizon. And boy, could he light up the east coast with that. 8 stacked high. I'm pretty sure you'll see a picture of it if you go to K1WHS on QRZ.com or I'm pretty sure he's got a website somewhere where he's got a picture of this thing. That's a serious collinear antenna with individual feed lines feeding each individual antenna with a power divider. So therefore, he has no doubt in his mind that they're all being fed in phase. And that's the problem. When you stack a very large number of them, you better be double darn sure they're all in phase. Otherwise, that pattern's going to tilt up above or below the horizon real fast. You're doing electronic steering, a phased array electronic steering. KB2 MAR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
So I guess that route of stacking beams one on top of the other, vertically polarized beams, would be easier to do rather than having a whole bunch of collinears all on one mast or fed at the bottom and then just have each one electronically work together. That sounds like it would be a lot harder to do. So basically, if I would stack two vertically polarized VHF Yagis, let's say each one maybe 10 element Yagis stacked one above the other, that would be easier to fine-tune than having everything stacked up the other way. And plus, I'd have more gain. Of course, you'd have to use a rotator, but that would look like an easier way to do it. And to find the formula to do the vertically stacked half waves one above the other, it would be hard to do something like that. Keep it trying to back to you, Dick.
I'm at Apple's or on.
You're catching on real fast, Gabe. The advantage that Dave, K1WHS, has is because he's got a power divider feeding individual cables to those eight antennas. He can easily cover the whole darn 2-meter band if he wants to, 144 to 148. As long as his power divider is built correctly, they're all being fed in phase no matter what frequency he's on. They're individually being fed. In his case, they're horizontally polarized, and there's nothing stopping him from making them vertically polarized if he wanted to. Because Dave is up there in Maine, and from his point of view, the majority of the VHF contest activity on 2 meters is along the east coast of the United States, from Maine down to Florida, so to speak. So he's got a relatively low gain Yagi for each individual Yagi that's vertically stacked, eight of them. I'm not sure of his exact horizontal beam width. I'm going to pick a number. It might be 50 degrees wide is his horizontal beam width. That covers the whole darn East Coast from his point of view up there in Maine. But now with this vertical stacking, he's picked up a huge amount of extra gain. Eight Yagis stacked can be something like 9 extra dB of gain above the gain of the individual Yagis. So his whole array probably has 18 dB, 20 dB of gain. And it is broadband because of the individual feeding. If he tried to do that with a vertical, with a series string from the bottom, although it would look on paper as a simpler feeding technique, he'd pick up all these disadvantages of phase shift versus frequency, if you know what I mean. So in your particular case, let me drop. If your motive is to have the highest possible gain vertically polarized, you're going to get the most amount of gain per pound of aluminum and per square foot of wind load out of Yagis. My favorite antenna, practical design, Yagis can really do magic. And if you can't get enough gain out of one single Yagi, then start stacking them horizontally, vertically. You pick up advantages in each way of doing it. And as long as you've got a strong enough mast, stacking them vertically as high as you want, if you know the gain of each individual one, and every time you double the number of antennas, you pick up, in theory, 3 decibels more gain, as long as the stacking distance is far enough that the individual capture areas are not overlapping. And you can easily calculate the exact amount of capture area of each antenna, as long as you know its gain, because there's a very exact formula doing that. And you can assume that that capture area is nearly a perfect diameter circle. And you can calculate that diameter knowing the area, so to speak. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you really know the gain of the antenna, then multiplying it by lambda squared divided by 4 pi tells you the real area. Let me drop. That tells you the real area in square meters. If you plugged in area lambda in meters, or if you plugged in lambda wavelength in feet, then the answer comes out in square feet. Gain lambda squared over 4 pi. That's the real area of a real antenna if you really know the gain. assume that that area is a circle. That tells you how close to stack the circles. Every time you double the number of antennas, 3 dB more gain takes place. If you go to the website called LimonTechNet.com, LimonTechNet.com, that's a